Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and as we mentioned earlier, New York City Councilman Richie Torres from the Bronx has been holding a news conference this hour detailing findings of an investigation into how Jared Kushner's real estate company allegedly failed to disclose to the city that many of his apartments were rent-stabilized. That failure to disclose could allow the company to illegally increase the rent for many New Yorkers. The finding also reveals a failure of city agencies to know what each other were doing in this area, because apparently one city agency knew but then didn't inform the others that might do something about it. Yesterday, in advance of the news conference, Torres, who chairs the Oversight and Investigations Committee, told WNYC News this.
These falsifications, the lies of Kushner Companies, was in plain view, was hidden in plain view. So it's a classic case of the right hand not knowing what the left hand is doing.
So with me now on that and more, including the Jerome Avenue rezoning and guns and school safety in New York City as we head toward the Saturday's March for Our Lives, is council member Vanessa Gibson, an affordable housing advocate and member of the Public Safety Committee representing West Bronx neighborhoods, including, let's see how close to right I get this list, Highbridge, Longwood, Melrose, Morris Heights, Morrisania, Mount Eden, and University Heights, as well as Claremont Village, Concourse, and Crotona Park. Hi, Council Member. Welcome back to WNYC.
Good morning, Brian. Good morning to WNYC. It's good to be back on the show.
How'd I do there with the district?
You got the majority of them right. You did good.
I was just this weekend on a long walk I took in the city, walked over. People don't even know this exists, but it's so cool to walk over the High Bridge, which is, once again, a pedestrian walkway, as it was once upon a time, and then it was closed for many years, and then it was reopened a couple of years ago. And I was taking a walk in the Bronx and toward Manhattan, walked that direction over the High Bridge, where you get this beautiful view up and down the Harlem River. And so just shouting out a prop to a little piece of your district that I happen to be in this weekend.
Thank you. We are so proud of the work the city's done. We opened the High Bridge 2 years ago. It's the oldest standing walking bridge in New York City. It's actually 1,400 steps. So if you walk from High Bridge to Washington Heights, you walk 1,400 steps.
All right. That's, I don't know if that quite counts according to medical science for my cardio for the day, but it was in the direction of it also. And also with us is Danny Lewis, WNYC reporter, on site just after your colleague Richie Torres's press conference about Jared Kushner's company. Danny, you there?
I am. Good morning, Brian.
Danny, you want to give us the headline?
Yeah, so it's Richie Torres is calling for an investigation into Kushner Companies. He says that they falsified building records, and you know, he's looking to not only investigate Kushner and other developers in the city, but he's also looking for new legislative action to tighten up, you know, as you said, communication between city agencies on this.
How specific was any allegation against Kushner's company with respect to any effect that it may have had on any actual New Yorker's rent-stabilized apartment?
Well, they said that there over a period of time after Kushner Company bought several buildings, they saw the number of rent-stabilized apartments in each of these buildings drop dramatically. I believe it was as much as 60% over the period of just a couple of years.
A 60% drop in rent-stabilized apartments
in each of these in rent-stabilized apartments in each of these buildings
that Kushner Companies bought. Where were they for the most part?
Brooklyn and Queens.
also with us for a few minutes. And council member, forgive me for adding so much company to this segment, but this breaking news story having to do with city council is really big. Also joining us for a few minutes is our own Andrea Bernstein, co-host of the podcast Trump Inc., which does exactly this, looks at Trump world private companies and their relationship to public policy. Hi, Andrea.
Hey, Brian.
So what are you making of this?
So we just did an episode for Trump Inc. titled Son-in-Law Inc. And this pattern sounds strikingly familiar. One of the things we talked about is the Kushner companies have large groups of moderate and low-income apartment complexes in Maryland. And they have been very legally aggressive with the tenants in a way that they say they are doing to maximize profits for their shareholders. It looks like this fits this pattern where they don't declare that there are rent-stabilized tenants. Therefore, they get less scrutiny. Therefore, there's a question about whether they were effectively monitored along the way. So we sort of see what happened going in and going out, but it's not clear if the fact that these papers were not filed correctly led to fewer rent-regulated tenants in Kushner apartments. Now, the Kushners say they outsourced the paperwork.
So they're not actually denying that paperwork was filed incorrectly about the rent-stabilized status of many apartments they own. The Kushner company is just saying, well, Jared doesn't sit at a desk and do this. They hire a paperwork company, and they screwed all of us.
They said they had outsourced it, and that when they were made aware of the violations, they corrected them. They also said they were not denying tenants their due process rights. However, if you expand out, this does fit into a larger pattern of their treating their landlord-tenant relationships very aggressively in New York, in Maryland. And there have also been complaints of that in New Jersey as well.
Is there a crime here?
Well, I'm not entirely familiar with the building code. I have not heard anything about there being anything criminal about this. But I think that this is sort of what it looks like is an example of their taking a very aggressive posture. And that's what they're like. And then if we sort of telegraph out even further, let's not forget that Jared Kushner, the former CEO of the company, is a senior White House advisor with an official position, and he still owns at least $761 million of company assets. So this is not like he joined the White House, he sold off all his assets, he built a wall, and he is over on a complete other side.
And our reporter Danny Lewis at the news conference adds that there were some apartments in Manhattan as well, so Brooklyn, Queens, and Manhattan. And I guess, Andrea, if there's a pattern here that could raise people's eyebrows about Jared Kushner, or at least add another question to the pile, he's already in trouble in Washington for failure to disclose things, for failure to disclose on his security clearance form that he had contacts with foreigners, Russians, among others, and that may be the reason that his security clearance just got downgraded. And yet again, here on the local level, having to do with people's rent-stabilized homes is another failure to disclose.
Exactly. And it's the same thing in Maryland. In fact, just in the last few weeks, what happened is the tenants sued the Kushner companies in Maryland, saying that they were unreasonably charging them late fees and getting them into a cycle of debt, basically, that they couldn't get out of. And they filed this in a Baltimore court. And the Kushner companies made a move to move it to a federal court, presumably because they would get a more diverse jury than they would get in Baltimore. So the Kushner companies, through their LLC, Westminster, tried to move it into federal court. And the judge said, okay, the rule is, as you know, you have to show us that you have nobody living in Maryland to move it to federal court. And they said, we don't want to release the names of our partners because we've already had too much media bias against us. And the judge said, tough, you have to. And they said, okay, we'll go back to court in Maryland. We'll take our chances with a Baltimore jury rather than tell you who our partners are. But the thing is this is actually the second time they had done this in Maryland. There was another case against them. They also tried to move. And when they were told, you have to tell us who the partners are, they said, oh, well, there are hundreds of members. We can't figure it out. We'll go back to a Baltimore jury. So non-disclosure is certainly something that we have seen before, a disinclination to disclose.
And wasn't FBI official Andrew McCabe just fired for failure to disclose something to the government? Just saying. Andrea Bernstein, listen to her increasingly popular and being listened to across the country, produced here at WNYC podcast, Trump, Inc. Thanks, Andrea.
Thank you, Brian.
And City Council Member Vanessa Gibson from the Bronx as an affordable housing advocate. There's also apparently a failure within city government here of one hand to know what the other hand was doing with respect to these Kushner properties, right?
Agreed. First and foremost, I think it's very unfortunate that this is even coming to light. I think it sends a loud message that we have to make sure that there is a better coordination between multiple agencies that oversee our affordable housing structure in the city of New York. I think it jeopardizes the fundamental principles of elected officials that fight so hard to get affordable housing in our district and make sure that tenants are given the necessities that they deserve in quality and affordable, stable and safe housing. I think it's alarming. I certainly think it's a call to action, and I applaud my colleague, Richie Torres, and others that will be stepping up and really talking about this, because we want everyone to follow the rules of the land, but we also want to make sure that agencies are doing their job too, as in terms of oversight. If HPD and the buildings department and everyone is working together doing their job, they have to talk to each other. And unfortunately, we've seen cases in the city where agencies are simply not talking to each other. The databases don't intersect, and everyone is working in a silo. And we cannot have that when you talk about affordable housing and the ongoing challenge we face in the city with families trying to access affordable housing. So I certainly look forward to working with my colleagues and, you know, whatever comes out of this, whether it's hearings or legislation. But certainly we want to make sure that everyone is following the law, and landlords, we're holding them accountable to a higher standard of service.
Even Councilman Richie Torres probably thinks this is just crazy, that here he is, the chair of the Investigations and Oversight Committee of City Council. That's supposed to mean investigations and oversight of city agencies. And so by doing that work and discovering that one agency knew things about rent-stabilized apartments being taken out of rent stabilization or having the rents unfairly bumped up, he's investigating one city agency not talking to another, and it turns out winding in the lap of the son-in-law, the controversial son-in-law of the President of the United States.
Right. Absolutely. And I do think that it sheds light on some of the deficiencies that we still have as city government and as city agencies. And certainly it is a call really to action to make sure that we do better. We have to hold ourselves accountable. There's an expectation that New Yorkers have of their government and elected officials, and we have to show them better. I think about all the residents and families that live in these buildings that were likely exploited, paying higher, you know, rents that they couldn't afford, and certainly that they should not have paid. I think about, you know, them being jeopardized, their public safety, their public health, and their overall well-being. And you think about all the worst cases because you just simply don't know. And for landlords and others that own property, that rent to tenants in the city to circumvent the process, every landlord usually outsources their management to another company, but they still work for the landlord. So there is a system of accountability that must be in place. You can't pass the buck of responsibility. You have to hold yourself accountable if your management company is not fulfilling its job.
And Ellen in Manhattan is calling with an accountability question, I think. Ellen, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Oh, hi, Brian and council member. And first, I just have to say how much I love your show and depend on it for good information.
Thank you.
I have a question, which is that is there any way that these apartments that had been rent stabilized and then have been destabilized could be returned to rent stabilization? And then a second part question is, can the tenants who have had their rents unfairly raised or who have actually lost their apartments, mm-hmm. can they have their apartments, if not restored to them, because now other people are living there innocently, but have some kind of financial remuneration and mm-hmm. some kind of help to get what they would have had someplace else, maybe in a fancy or high-rent apartment owned by these same landlords.
And thank you, Ellen, for going to the stories of the victims, not just the perpetrators. Councilmember, have you gotten that far?
So I think these are preliminary conversations that we're having now within the council, but it's a few things. Depending on if the state housing agency, HCR, has any oversight, they need to get involved because they're the ones that monitor all of the registering of affordable units of housing in the state of New York. So that's a question. Certainly, legal consultation could be an option because the tenants that lived in these rent-regulated units that are no longer there could be afforded the right to come back to be transferred to another unit. There could be potential rent rollback options where they were paying more in rent than they should have. So I think this is part of, you know, unfortunately, a complicated process that will involve state agency and potentially legal advice, because we really need to make sure that these tenants were not violated and their due process was not violated. So we are early in the conversations, but certainly the city council and its role, oversight of city agencies and city government, we will be involved in this because not only is this a crucial issue, but it sends a message to the other bad actors out there that we will not accept them circumventing the law and trying to get away with exploiting tenants and families on fixed incomes. That is unacceptable.
And as an affordable housing advocate, I want to touch on the Jerome Avenue rezoning, which has passed the Land Use Committee. Now, for people who don't know that part of the city, Jerome Avenue runs north-south along much of the Bronx. The number 4 train runs above it as an elevated line along a good stretch of Jerome Avenue, Yankee Stadium up north of there. And the mayor's rezonings have been so controversial, as you know, Councilmember, in many neighborhoods because of fears that they'll gentrify more than make the neighborhood more affordable. You support this rezoning, I gather, which has now passed the Land Use Committee. Tell us why.
Yeah, so 3 years ago when the City Department of Planning put forth the Jerome Neighborhood Plan, it was really with the expectation that we in the city need to prepare for an expected population growth to 9 million people. And certain neighborhoods like Jerome could potentially be changed in terms of zoning and allow for more density. So at first, I agreed. These zonings have always been controversial, and they always will be, unfortunately. But I wanted to look at it as an opportunity to get necessary capital resources in my district, investments that my residents have needed for the longest time. We have not rezoned any part of the Bronx since the 1960s. And I wanted to use this as an opportunity to stimulate development, to stimulate growth, and to strengthen families and give them the resources that they already needed. So looking at neighborhood rezonings, the contextual plan of it is R7 to R8 and M1 and C1 and commercial manufacturing areas and looking at mixed use. But for me, it's the neighborhood. It's the burden on the school seats, school district 9 and 10. It's the mass transit options. It's the parkland, the open space. It's the services for youth and families and mission-driven organizations. And really what we wanted to do is to make sure that this plan was a plan that really came from the community, from the ground up. It was not easy. Fernando Cabrera and I represent this area, and it has been a challenge for the 3 years we've been working on this to really come up with what is best for the future. There were a lot of meetings, a lot of town halls and listening sessions, and we really tried our very best to put together a holistic plan. And yes, it's passed the Land Use Committee. It will be voted on this week by the full council. And I and Fernando are very supportive because it is over $189 million of investment. $60 million in parks, $50 million in DOT infrastructure work, two brand new schools, the first zoning in the city to achieve two brand new elementary schools in District 9 and District 10. It is money for community groups to organize and to fight against harassment and anti-displacement. The certificate of no harassment is starting in our district. We have money for auto repair and workers so that they can be strengthened and grow within an industry that's very vital to our district. There's a lot of things. There's housing preservation. There's new construction on public and privately owned land. It's a very, very ambitious plan. And I will also say as I close that under this plan, there are three task forces that have been started and will begin in this neighborhood plan. One that's on public health, because we know the Bronx remains number 62 out of all the counties in the state when you talk about positive health outcomes. There's a task force on responsible contracting and local hiring, which is very important to labor to create good jobs that families can live on and be lifted out of poverty. And the third one is really a partners in preservation dealing with South Bronx housing and dealing with distressed buildings that remain a priority to all of us. I think it's important to recognize that nothing has been done to this magnitude since the 1960s. So we really have an opportunity to do better. We have a chance to slow down gentrification and keep families in their homes. And we have the resources of tax credits and government subsidies to stimulate the type of housing that we know families need. The lowest on the income spectrum, 30% AMI set aside for families coming from shelters, housing for veterans and seniors. This is all a part of the conversation. No one has been ignored. I've listened to everyone. And even now, as it passes, there still remains a lot of work to be done. So I'm proud of where we are. I worked really hard on this, and I'm really looking forward to the future conversations about the future of a borough that has been starved for many, many years.
You're talking about so many aspects of neighborhood improvement, schools and parks and investment toward jobs. Is it sort of all of that in exchange for allowing developers to build high-rise buildings in the area and add more market-rate apartments?
So no, it's not in exchange, but it's a complement. It's a part of the larger conversation. In our district, we cannot build market-rate housing today. We will not be able to build market-rate housing tomorrow. But this rezoning does allow density. So R7 and R8 today will go to R9. That means a couple of more stories from an 8 to 10 to a 12 to 14 story building. We're not going to see skyscrapers in this part of the Bronx. So let me be clear, we won't see luxury housing and condominiums. The market does not support that type of housing, and the zoning will not propel that. It is going to stimulate affordable housing, mixed-use housing, housing for those at the low end of the spectrum, middle-income opportunities, housing for seniors and veterans, and it's going to create a diversity of all incomes that are really important. I get a lot of pressure from families that are living on fixed incomes to stay in their apartments, but they also want to live better. They're not happy with their current conditions. But I always get concerns about college graduates, grandchildren that are coming home from college, that are professionals working in the hospital sector, in the public sector, and they can't afford any of the apartments. So I think it's a real challenge to find a balance and a mixture to make sure that families at 30% AMI can live, as well as those at 40, 50, 60, and 70. So that's been the challenge, but this neighborhood plan is going to achieve that balanced spectrum.
Last question. With the March for Our Lives coming up this Saturday, and you as a longtime member of the Public Safety Committee, and I know gun violence has been one of your concerns, is this going to draw a turnout from your district, or do people consider this sort of a suburban thing?
No, I think generally residents across my district from all spectrums care about public safety. We have a fundamental right to be safe in our neighborhoods. We have been plagued in the West Bronx with gun violence, with children that we're losing to the endless cycle of illegal handguns in our communities. And we in the council, when I chair public safety for the last 4 years, we passed incredible measures to not only bring equity to the system, but to do something different, to look at Cure Violence as a model to take guns out of young people's hands and replace it with a job, with a program, after school, summer youth, all the things that this council stands firmly passionate about. And I appreciate all of the concerns. I mean, these mass shootings are horrifying. They're disturbing. But I am not in support of giving teachers and educators guns in our schools. The pipeline to prison is real in our city and in our district. And we want to reduce those pipelines and make sure that young people feel safe, not like they're going to jail in school. And we have to reduce that. We have to look at other measures and intervention and why young people pick up guns in the first place.
Yes.
The mental health, the suicidal teens that feel like that's their only option. We have to change that and not be reactionary, because we often do that. We're too reactionary instead of being preventative. So I appreciate the work and look forward to more opportunities in this season with my new speaker, Corey Johnson, and making sure that we look at preventative measures and not reactionary.
And after the news, we're going to be talking about one, well, some people might call it preventative, some people might call it reactionary. It's the so-called red flag laws. One was just passed in Florida after Parkland that'll make it easier for the government to take guns away from people who have legally had them in certain circumstances. And we'll look at the tension there between public safety and constitutional rights coming up after the news. But just one final follow-up question, and we appreciate you staying over your scheduled time since we took a detour early on to talk about that Jared Kushner issue. The handguns that you mentioned as the bigger gun problem in your area and in the city in general, really, is, do you think it's getting lost? There was a time when the big gun control lobby group in this country was called Handgun Control, Inc. And now it seems like with the mass school shootings and other mass shootings and these military-style assault weapons, people are kind of not caring about the handgun issue anymore. And they're sort of saying, okay, let people have their handguns for personal safety. But we just have to make sure these military rifles, AR-15s and things like that, get regulated. And nobody's talking about handguns. Is that a problem?
Yes, that's a problem, because it remains a conversation that we have to talk about. The reality is the mass shootings continue because of the high capacity weapons, assault weapons, and AK-47s and AR-15s. And we should deal with that at a federal level and take these guns out of the hands of individuals who should not have them. But on a local level, in our black and brown communities, illegal handguns remains a challenge, and the easy access that young people have to getting these guns in the first place. I think that's very relevant. We have had way too many shootings, and particularly shootings of children has been disturbing. And I don't accept it. And I think while we deal with the mass shootings and the large high magazine weapons, we also have to talk simultaneously about the illegal handguns that end up in our minority communities in the city of New York.
West Bronx City Council Member Vanessa Gibson, thank you so much.
Thank you, Brian.